Yes, let's give the date. December 18th, 2023. Hello. Glad to be here. Like the rabbi said, I won't be here next week. I'll be here in 2 weeks. We're in the midst of Zalman Bear Bamberger, although I saw that it went out today. It didn't say that. It said that, although I hope on the YouTube, that's
No,
what I'll have it.
that was just on the email, just to get people's
Got
attention. You actually read it. It actually did say Bear Burger.
Yes,
I'll
okay.
make it different ways so people can open and come. You always have to have a marketing guy, although I'm probably not so good at that.
Yes, so definitely. As the secession controversy. We are focusing on the secession controversy. We're going to get back to Zalman Bear Bamberger just himself soon in a few more classes, but this is really what he's associated with. But I do want to return to Bamberger for a minute because some people are confused. Well, some. For if one person's confused, I assume there's others. Sometimes he's Yitzhak Dov, sometimes he's Zalman Bear. And I think one of you said even well that's his like sec is his Goyish name or something. No. So let me make something straight here. And I don't know if our Naftali's here with us live like last week when he was in Israel, because he would have what to add as well. In Germany, among the German Orthodox, there were two names that were given. One was the Shem Kodesh, the Jewish name. So the Rabbi Bamberger, his name is Yitzhak Dov, or your name could be Menachem. Then we had what was called a Shem Chol, a secular name, the name that would be used for everything else. That's what your wife would call you. That's what your friends. That's what you'd sign documents. That was your name. This is not a Goyish name. This isn't a Christian name. This isn't a name like Mark or anything. This is a Jewish name. But it's a secular name, and you'd be called up to the Torah. It's not like today where a Chabadnik gets called up for the Torah. It's Yamod, Menachem Mendel ben this. No, you'd only be called up Menachem. That's your Shem Kodesh. You also have a Shem Chol. In fact, in German Orthodox circles, there's a whole ceremony. What's it called? A Chol Kreish, I think, where his name is actually given. As I recall, it's when the mother goes the first time to shul after the baby's born. But it's not a Goyish name. It's not a name. And this was standard. So take the name of Rav Zalman Bear Bamberger. That's his Shem Chol. But he's called to the Torah as Yitzhak Dov, but that's how he's known. Why did they have these two names? I'm not sure why they had these two names. It could be that it was thought, I mean, Rabbi Hamburger in his book, Shorshei Min HaAshkenaz, has a whole section on this. I glanced at it today and I didn't see that he gave a reason for it other than that it just, for whatever reason, it's maybe he has it, but I didn't find it there as to why they developed this, other than perhaps I would think maybe to make a separation. Your holy name is when you're called up to the Torah, things like that. We don't use it for everyday things. But I'm not sure exactly where that come from or why they did it. Avraham Avinu and Moshe Rabbeinu, they only had one name. So why can't, why do we need just names that are Dvarim Shebikdusha? Tfilos and things like that. I don't know. The name Dov, the name has bear, which is in German, Yiddish. We know that name, but again, you wouldn't be called up Dov Bear. It's just Dov is your name. Now, the name Dov is itself interesting. I took a look. I have this big book, the Otzar Rabbanim. It has. This is by the late Rav Nosson Zvi Friedman of B'nai Brak. He has a list. This book here includes 20,189 rabbis with their names, their identifying information. It's like a baseball card on the back. They identify information, where they're played. So this is where they're born or their dates. Everyone is called Gon before some things like that. The sfarim they wrote, who their Rebbe was often, who their child or their grandchild was, their father-in-law. So lots of names. So I look, there's lots of Dov, a lot of Dov there as well. In fact, if you look at the Dovs here, basically every single one that I can see, just almost everyone, is either Dov Bear or Dov Bearish. Not all of them, but almost everyone. I don't see one Sephardic rabbi that has the name Dov. It seems like it was only an Ashkenazic name. And of course, the name itself. Why would anyone be named Dov? I mean, we have names. We have all sorts of names. Tzvi and other things. And new Israeli names. Kfir. There was something with one of the hostages named Kfir, as I recall. But the name Dov is itself a bit of a strange name. I mean, we have a lot of people with the name Dov, only because I'll tell you why it's a bit of a strange name, I think, is that if you look in the Gemara, Megillah, Yud Aleph Amud Aleph, it says Rav Yosef taught that those who are referred to as a bear in this verse, in this pasuk, are the Persians. They are compared to a bear as they eat and drink in large quantities like a bear. They're coated with flesh like a bear. They grow their hair long with a bear. They never rest like a bear. So in other words, bear, as far as the Gemara is concerned, a bear is not such a good animal. A dove is not such a good animal. It has these bad characteristics. So I'm not sure exactly how Dove became a good and very respected name. Not clear about that at all. But it doesn't appear to be and maybe people listening tell me, do Sephardim today name their kids Dove? I guess they would. It's become a popular name, but classically it's not. I listened to the okay, so someone privately texted me. He's going to be meeting with Rabbi Hamburger. He can ask him the story. It might be in the book, but I just did this before class and I skimmed through it and I didn't see where he actually explained where the min. He shows the Rishonim, late Rishonim, Achronim, who mentioned this practice, but like the Svara, why come up with this? We spoke about this before, and I emailed with Rabbi Hamburger today, but I didn't remember to ask him because, again, I wanted to ask him about Shamshon. I started thinking about that. Like you said, the name is Shamshon. Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, not Shimshon. That's his Shem Kodesh and also a Shem Chol. Sometimes they're both. He was called up to the Torah as Shamshon. So I asked Rabbi Hamburger why they didn't name him Shimshon, the Hebrew name. So he gave a possibility, and previously, someone sent me something from Rav Mordechai Breuer that maybe Shimshon was, he's a gibor, but he also had certain unsavory characteristics, if you know, in Shoftim. So that's a far-fetched. I don't know. I listened to the class, and if you heard it, I said about an onan. I'm still talking about the situation. My wife, who was an onan on Friday. And I did some research. I looked in the Kol Ba'alei and other places. Some people there's actually an opinion, but it's not accepted that basically we shouldn't have onanim today at all. And because we're not involved, there's two reasons for it: either you're involved with the mace or because of kavod hamace. But if you give it to the if the body's already taken and is taken to the funeral parlor and they're in charge of it, why should you have onan? So it's obviously it has to be the reason kavod hames. But Friday all the way to Sunday be an onan, okay? But we assume that's what the halacha is. So I wondered, about saying the bracha, and then I said, well, what about even lighting the Shabbos candles? So of course Shabbos candles shalom bayis. So maybe the man should light Shabbos candles. Why have the woman light it? But we know that you do light it, and the reason I think is clear because it's connected to Shabbos, and there you don't have the own status of onan on Shabbos, so that's why I think the standard view is that you make the woman still makes the Shabbos bracha, because the candles are connected to Shabbos. If you recall, we went through this in detail. I'm not going to go through this again. The candle, the blessing, the bracha on the Shabbos lights is not even a Talmudic blessing. You might recall we spoke about this. It's a post-Talmudic blessing. It's not in the Gemara that you make such a bracha. And although we have this notion that you're not supposed to make a bracha unless it's found in the Gemara, as we've said numerous times, we have lots of examples of this, which is not true. Many examples are post-Talmudic brachos. So Shabbos candles is one of them as well. I don't know how that would affect Onan or anything, but last class, I also misspoke. I can't seem to remember this. I always get this wrong in discussing the name of Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch's Sefer. Well, it was published by Klugman. I always say Shemesh Marpeh. Other people say it as well, but it's Shemesh Marpeh. How do we know it's Shemesh Marpeh? Well, it's from this pasuk in Malachi, chapter 3, verse 20. It says, "Vizarcha Lachem Yerei Shemi Shemesh Tzedakah Umarpeh Bichnafeha." So he combined Shemesh Umarpeh becomes Shemesh Marpeh, and it looks like Shemesh, like Shamshon. Marpeh looks like Raphael in there. You got the Resh payoff. Professor Breuer told me he hates the name. He doesn't think, but whatever, that's where it comes from. Shemesh Tzedakah is the name of another volume of Tshuvot. Rav Shimshon Merpurgo. He's the teacher of Mendelssohn. He put his own student in Cheirim. Not so common to have to do that. But I was talking about Rabbi Klugman, and which book is... So this book, how impressed I was, how much I like it. And I said, I don't really, he stresses certain things, obviously, but I said it's an honest portrayal. It's not hagiography. And I wasn't aware, although I said in the book Shemesh Marpeh, I'm aware that he didn't include the letters on Agadah, which actually Naftali pointed out to me are included in the new, in the night, he reminded me. In the, was it the eighth or the ninth volume of the collected writings of Hirsch? That's very important letters, two letters of Rav Shmuel Hirsch explaining his position on Agadah. But I said, I don't know of any examples where, granted, he has his own stresses, but he leaves things out. And I thank Nachum Shmariahu, who called my attention to this podcast, which I can't remember if I heard it. And if I heard it, I definitely didn't remember what he pointed out. This is Professor Micha Gottlieb of NYU, who published a book. A large portion of it deals with Hirsch a few years ago, deals with Bible translations. And he points out that there are problems in the Klugman book. There's nothing, I said last class that. A big problem with the Art Scroll books, it's not that they say things that are false, it's that they don't say the whole truth. That is, they leave things out, which leaves you with a wrong opinion. Now, I'm not putting Rabbi Klugman's book in that category at all of the other books, but Goodman points out, he points out something which I checked, and it's true that Klugman unfortunately also suffers from this to a small degree. I mean, the way Goodman terms it is that this is written from a contemporary Haredi perspective. That's clear. That's true. There is a bit of a problem on the title page, but I don't know if Goodman had anything to do with it. The beard on Hirsch has been expanded, as I see it. If you look at the original picture, the beard is not so full like this. But there are at least two facts from Hirsch's lifetime that are not included in the book or get ignored or downplayed. Number one, very important to Hirsch is his grandfather, Mendel Frankfurter, he's mentioned in this book. But what Klugman does not mention is that Mendel Frankfurter was very close to Mendelssohn. Even you perhaps you can call him a Talmud. You'll get that if you look in Rosenboom's book. You don't have that here. And he was from a Maskilic background. Klugman also doesn't deal with the fact that the main education of Hirsch was not as Klugman portrays it, as you would get from it, that it was in yeshiva. No, it was in public school, gymnasium, or the secular Jewish gymnasium. It was a gymnasium or the Jewish school, not the yeshiva. If you read Klugman, you get the sense that he was educated in yeshivas. That's his whole education. It's not true. So I take back what I said, and yes, this book also. Klugman's book, an excellent, excellent book, but it still, for whatever reason, doesn't leaves that out, which I think is unfortunate. Okay, there's another thing I want to returning to the Bamberger in Klugman, and now we pick up with the class, page 177. He has a whole chapter. He discusses the Bamberger-Hirsch dispute, and he says, quote, "Rabbi Bamberger's ruling remains a source of mystery even today." And he says, I don't think it's a mystery. He thinks it's a mystery. I think Bamberger explains himself very well. Hirsch said it's a mystery. Hirsch said, how could you say one thing and then contradict it? And Bamberger explains in detail why he changed his mind. And Klugman then says that he explains how Bamberger at other times championed secession. He says there have been conjectures concerning Rad Bomberger's motives, but he's not gonna reach any conclusions. But so that I don't see at all. He is correct. The next page is saying that some have presented the affair as a disagreement in principle, with Hirsch advocating secession and Bomberger not. And we've already pointed out that's not correct, that Bomberger had no problem with secession. If the people wanted it, even in Frankfurt. However, what he then says, and this I have to say, Krugman could be right. I'm not sure. I haven't been able to determine it. I know that in later discussions, this isn't mentioned. It's not mentioned also in what Reclaim Moser Grzynski is going to say. Reclaim Moser implies differently, as well as all the other sources. The way it's usually portrayed in all the discussions, and this is what it was like in the other communities, is that when the non-Orthodox agreed to give the Orthodox everything they wanted, then the Orthodox could remain in those communities, and you could assume that the Orthodox and the Orthodox tax money is not going to the Reform institutions because they're the minority, and no Orthodox money can go there. And that's is understood. And since they're a minority, it's not an issue. And I mentioned last class that Rabbi Moshe Mainz worked out a compromise where, and you can see this in Liberalis's book on page 215, that Moshe Mainz's position, they worked out that they would not, their taxes would be reduced. It said, what's the exact wording here? They would exempt Orthodox Jews from contributing to the Reform synagogue and school. That doesn't mean that the taxes were lessened. It means that they were exempted from contributing. I think it means, I don't think it means that they were exempted. I mean, it was lessened, although maybe it does. And in return, those people, namely those Orthodox Jews who went with this path, were denied voting rights in the community. And then I told you that though the majority of the members of Hirsch's community, the majority of the Orthodox, they didn't do anything. They didn't agree to, they just continued the way they were. They paid taxes to the Hirschian community and they were members of the general community. What's unclear is if Bomberger, and it's unclear from his open letter, if Bomberger actually required this additional step of the Mainzes to agree, that is in some way form of a written agreement that your money would never go to the Reform community, or you can just assume that you're in the minority, so it doesn't go, and that you could therefore not be a member, you could not be on the community council at all as an Orthodox Jew or have any involvement. To me, it's not clear because it's obvious when you read Bomberger that the Orthodox Jews will be on the hospital board. But the implication of what Liberalist says is that if you agreed to this compromise where your money didn't, maybe it means you paid less money or whatever, the money didn't specifically didn't go to the Reform, you couldn't be on the community, you couldn't be on the board of the community, which I assume means you couldn't be on the hospital board also. And that's not when Bomberger says that an Orthodox Jew can't be on the hospital board. That's before, that's in February of 1877. That's before the community changed its policy. So I'm really not sure about this. And I know in other communities they didn't require this. So I don't know if Hirsch, he doesn't mention this, and he just says that as long as the Orthodox and everything they want is taken care of. So I'm not sure about that. But I can tell you it didn't take place in other places. And it wasn't the issue of Reb Mordechai Horovitz, who is the community rav, as we'll see, didn't hold to this either. Let me mention one more point about Bomberger and then take the story further. There was a great rabbi in Hungary. His name was Reb Moshe Schick, Maromshik, student of the Chasam Sofer. Actually, in Hungary, he's one of the moderates. When I say moderates, because there's real Hildesheimer is what you call a liberal. And he's one of the moderates. We're going to talk about the Hungarian separatism, the so-called Teilung, and how Rav Moshe Schick was sort of forced into agreeing to some extreme measures that he didn't really see the basis for, but he went along with it. But What I want to mention now is that he was alerted to this controversy between Hirsch and Bomberger, and he sends a letter, a tshuva, to Bomberger. I just want to tell you what he says in this. It's Maram Shik Tshuvos Orachaim number 306. And of course, he addresses him with all the big titles. So he knows what a Godel Bisrael is. But he writes that he's surprised to hear that, Bamberger said that you can be in the same community with the reformers. His facts are incorrect. He says, I heard that because the reform want to be in one community, that you've agreed to do that. That's not what happened at all. But that's what he says. And he says, I don't know how you could do this. He says, Pashut, it's obvious that it's forbidden. It's Asr Torah. It's forbidden, according to the Torah, to be together with these heretics. He cites a number of sources that you can't join together with heretics and Chotim, Machtim, he gives a number of examples. He says we need to be completely separated from them. He says that we can take karbonos, sacrifices from non-Jews, but we can't take from mumrim, from complete heretics, apostates, the rest. We can't take from them, and these reformers are in that category. And we don't say about these mumrim, the efshar shagesa yeshivu b'tshuva. We don't say that maybe if we have involvement with them, we can bring them to a tshuva. We say no. We don't say that because when it comes to Mechal Shabbos Pefer Hesse and Hikorsim, we can't accept the sacrifice. I've noticed the Maram Shik includes Mechal Shabbos Pefer Hesse, just like reformers. In Germany at this time, you had a number of Mechal Shabbos Pefer Hesse, but they went to the traditional shul. So they were not reformers. They were believers. They just were not practicing. They were the non-observant Orthodox. He says, "Asur lanu liyos b'shutvus imahem," including in the basic pharos. Why can't you be? Because you can't bury a Russia with a tzaddik. Look, you always had Orthodox Jews, traditional Jews with non-Orthodox, but they had a section. They would have, if there was one communal cemetery, the traditional Jews would have their own section in it because they didn't want to be buried next to Shabbos violators. But the Maram Shik says absolutely not. He says that it's known that this is going to be have bad results. And he says even if the first generation of traditional Jews are not miskalkel, are not led astray, we know that later generations will be led astray by being together with them. And he says, now that I've set forth my opinion, I ask you, great Rabbi, Kvod Hadras Gaono, not to stand on your opinion, because we find that even among the Chazal, if they said things that was incorrect, they were not ashamed to admit, Tos Ein Biadenu, that we made a mistake. Ushkoga Yotza, Milifnei Hashalit, and, this is a mistake, so that we can acknowledge we made a mistake. So you too, Rabbi Bomberger, you should acknowledge that your error, that Rav Hirsch is correct. And he says that I even know one time when someone came to the Chasam Sofer, Rav Moshe Sofer, and tricked him into giving an approbation, a haskama. And later, the Chasam Sofer realized that it was a shkaga, it was a mistake. And he publicly apologized or made a public declaration that he made a mistake. Now, he's referring, he was moda ala emes. So what he's referring to is that there was a person named Pinner. He wanted to do a translation into German of the Talmud, and he came to Pressburg, and the Chasam Sofer was impressed by him, and he gave him an approbation. And then it came out that things that Chasam Sofer didn't know that led him to retract his approbation. That Pinner, I guess, he had Haskalah tendencies. There's a lot to say about Pinner because it's a famous story. It shows the Chasam Sofer was not afraid to publicly renounce something which he did. And he says that for all the time Pinner was with me, I didn't see any problem with him, but I've heard from others, and therefore I'm retracting my approbation. I don't think that this is such a big deal to retract something if you said something and then you learn that there's other information, so you retract it. That's not like Reb Bamberger, where he's being told to retract a halachic opinion because he's wrong. Well, there have been examples of rabbis who've revoked smicha. I don't know what that means. I don't know what I mean, when you have smicha, does that mean that it continues forever? I'm not sure really what the mechanism is, but there have been cases where rabbis have given smicha and then the person said things or behaved in an inappropriate way. So they said that my smicha is batel mevutal. It's not valid. And I guess an Orthodox synagogue, well, I shouldn't say that because it depends. If someone got smicha, let's say from a Satmar rabbi, and then he became a Tzioni, a Zionist, Rachmano Litzlan. And then the Satmar rabbi announced that I'm being Mevatel HaSmicha. I don't think a modern Orthodox synagogue would care. You know, it all depends on why he's being Mevatel the Smicha. By the way, in terms of Satmar, something amazing came out this week. There was a guy in Satmar, he converted, and he converted to Satmar, believe it or not. And he's a complete goy, and he becomes Satmar, and he picks up all the lingo. I mean, he has the Yiddish accent. It's amazing. And after 5 years in Satmar, he was married also. He left it all and reverted to to Christianity. And he did an interview with Zev Brenner last week, the Zev Brenner Show. And it's an amazing story. First of all, I just love listening to this non-Jewish guy. I guess he's Jewish. He's Jewish. And his Yiddish accent, how he picked it up. And I mean, he sat and learned in Satmar for years. And then you have all these guys calling up on the show saying he's going to Gehenna and everything. And he says that doesn't matter to me because I don't believe it anymore. But so that's interesting about Satmar. But so that's the Maharam Shik. And of course, Bamberger didn't retract his position. Now, because of the Maharam Shik, because of the agreement with the general community, one of the things they said they would do for the Orthodox is create a synagogue, build a brand new synagogue, and they build a mikveh, all the things they're going to do, and therefore they appointed a rabbi, and this rabbi, his name was Rav Mordechai Horovitz or Marcus Horovitz. Marcus, by the way, is the non-Jewish name. That's not a shem chol. Now, Frankfurt was a big community. After Berlin, Frankfurt is the big community. And there's not just German Jews there. There's Jews from Eastern Europe. And as I mentioned, the Jews from Eastern Europe, they came from towns which didn't have separatism. So they had no problem. Most of the East European Jews joined the general Frankfurt community. And that's how things remained until the end of German Orthodoxy, as we'll see. But the German Orthodox in the regular community called the Gemeinde, they now had the opportunity to appoint a rabbi, a Rav, a Talmud Chacham of the high first order. And they appoint a figure, as I said, Marcus Mordechai Horovitz. He's the author of Vayim Metshuvos called Matei Levi. He studied under Rav Chaim Tzvi Mannheimer in Hungary. We'll see why he's important, as well as under Rav Israel Hildesheimer, who's Talmud Mufak, the leading student he became. Rav Israel Hildesheimer did not want him to take this position. But once he took the position, then Hildesheimer accepted it, and Hildesheimer came to Frankfurt, actually, after he accepted this position. Now, what's interesting about him is that he was also a member of the B'nai B'rith, and he was also a member, he was also an anti-Zionist. In fact, he signed a declaration with five other rabbis, three of them non-Orthodox, two Orthodox, non-Reform. And because of that, Herzl termed these rabbis the protest rabbiner. And so Horovitz is known as one of the protest rabbiner, that because he protested against Zionism. So you can read all about it in the Jerusalem Post. Just Google. It's one word, not two words. Contrary to this protest rabbiner, and one of them is Horovitz. The other Orthodox rabbi is Eliezer Auerbach from the famous Auerbach family of Halberstadt. But about 20 years ago, 25 years ago, I think it was Haaretz, did an article on these protest rabbiner, and all their descendants basically are living in Adnas HaKodesh in the land of Israel. The descendants of Mordechai Horovitz are yeshivas Devar Yerushalayim. If you know that yeshiva, Baal Tshuva Yeshiva, that's the descendants, and they are much more Haredi, and it's a bit ironic, than the Matei Levi. So, but they appoint this Rav, Ramordach Haravitz. He's known by his volume of tshuvos as the Matei Levi, but as I said, an open-minded person, member of B'nai B'rith, very much, and he was involved in the general organization. There were two rabbinic organizations in Germany. One of them was just for Orthodox Jews, and one was like the New York Board of Rabbis, Orthodox and non-Orthodox. He was involved with this. Yaakov Rosenheim, after he gives a hesped for him, even though the Breuers wanted nothing to do with him, and Shamsher Rav Hirsch refused to meet with him when he came to town. In his volume of Tshuvos, number Schelag Beis Orach Chaim 36, he explains to us important things about his appointment as the general communal rabbi. So when you speak about the Orthodox Jews of Frankfurt, you need to distinguish between the communal Orthodox and the separatist Orthodox. And this letter is to his Rebbe, Rav Chaim Tzvi Mannheimer, one of the Gedolim of Hungary. He's the author of the Tshuvos Ein HaBdolach. So he writes to Rabbi Mannheimer, and he, as I said, he explains the whole situation in Frankfurt, and that he was chosen to come be rabbi. He says all the Orthodox in this community want picked me to come, and he says the other rabbis I've consulted with, they advised me shemitzvah, it's a mitzvah for me to go there and be mekadesh shem shemayim. Why? Because the heads of the community, that is the non-Orthodox, saw that they couldn't keep the community together only if they gave the Orthodox the following. So this is what the Orthodox were given, and this is what Ramordach Haravitz points to. He doesn't point to anything, as we'll see, about that you have to sign a separate document, that you're not in, that your money doesn't go to the non-Orthodox. This is what he says it is. One, that they're going to build a mikveh, altaras adin vahidur, a nice new mikveh. Two, that all the shochtim will be under my hashgacha, and the ein rishus reform rabbiner hagid lahem davar, that the reform rabbis can have nothing to say to the shochtim at all. That all those who sell meat, if they want to say kosher, it has to be under my hashgacha. Of course, the Hirshim community can have their own beef, the meats, the butchers. That the four, the shul that I will daven in will be Nusach Frankfurt, Yoshan Noshan, the old Nusach of Frankfurt. This shul, the old shul in Frankfurt, the Gemeinde shul, which they regarded themselves as the continuation of the old Frankfurt Minhag, going back to all the Gedolei Yisrael, Pnei Yeshua, et cetera, et cetera. Maram Shif, that it will be the old Nusach. But this shul was the, as far as I know, the last shul in Europe, maybe the world. I don't know about Yemen, so leave that out. Certainly in Europe, to my knowledge, the last shul to adopt Lecha Dodi. Lecha Dodi is the last prayer, was it 16th century, the last prayer to make it into the liturgy. And Hirsch's community accepted it, and they would accept it also, this, but there was this, it's in Geiger's book on the Minhagim of Frankfurt that they said it. So already the first half of the 19th century, they're saying it, but it's the last Frankfurt, the old Frankfurt shul is the last one to accept it. Okay, so you need to have this, the old Nusach, that is no changing of the Frankfurt Nusach, no adjustments to it. He says, Ein l'shum adam r'shus l'shano shum davar b'li ritzoni, that he's the absolute authority. No changes can be made. He says that I'm going, this is the shul where I'll give drashas at, not any other shul unless I want. And then that, and this is important. The Reform Jews are not going to be in the Beis Din. Remember, we had this problem in Frankfurt. We discussed it in the classes dealing with Reform Judaism. Geiger was placed on the Beis Din. and in Frankfurt, and we spoke about the problem that the old Dayan didn't die and wouldn't serve with him. It's none of that's going to happen. That he says there's going to be just me and Shnei Dayani Mumchim v'Yireyim. So they're going to have an Orthodox based in completely separate. And he says after and once the community agreed to that, then Amarti Mitzvah Gedola Kazoa Kadeshim Shemayim. He said that it's a great mitzvah to join this community. And he speaks, and this is, as he understands it, this is in line with Rabbi Bamberger's position. So there's nothing here about the special compromise that you have to agree that your money is not going to go, because your money's not going to go. Well, that's the, as you're the minority. That's clear from it. And he says that Rav Hirsch has his own community, but I'm in the Eidah Gedolah, the larger community. And then he goes on, he has a shaila about mikvahs, about the new mikvah. He has a question based on how they built mikvahs in Germany, and he has a shaila. Now, afterwards, we have a letter that Rabbi Mannheimer from Hungary, they're the extremists over there in Hungary, where he writes to him and he says, Mazel tov that you've come to this community and that you're going to be Ligdor Geder Valamo, that you're going to be successful. So his Rebbe doesn't say to him, Chas v'shalom, how can you join such a community where now you're in a community with reformers? No, he explained that the only thing that's in the community, yes, technically we're in the same community, but we have complete autonomy. And therefore his Rebbe doesn't see a problem with that. Rav Horovitz remained Rav there until his passing. Let's see, I forget 1910. He was succeeded by a rabbi who died. Unfortunately, he didn't live that long, died young. His name was Rav Nechemya Noble, Franz Rosenzweig's teacher, and someone very was it Rosenzweig? He had influence on him. Many others as well. Yeah. I don't know. I won't know if I call him a teacher. As my recollection is that he was influential. Everyone loved Rav Nechemya Noble. He was a great preacher, famous and for his preaching. He was also a great Talmudic scholar, but we don't have much from him, although he did write a kuntros, the Eruv. Of course, the general community had an Eruv. And he wrote a tshuva explaining the Erev and defending it. Needless to say, this Erev was posseled by the Hirshian community. When he died, they needed another rabbi, and just like the Hirshian community did, they had to go to Hungary to find one, and they found one. His name was Yaakov Hoffman. We're fortunate; we have a whole book. Look at this thick book. This thick. He establishes a yeshiva. He's from Hungary, Talmud Chacham. He establishes a yeshiva there. So there's two yeshivas. Actually, there's a third yeshiva too. Schneider's yeshiva was called, but you had the Hirshian community yeshiva. Hirsch never established a yeshiva, although he intended to, but he never did. It was his son-in-law who established it. And the fact when his son-in-law, Rabbi Breuer, wanted to establish it, the people in the community, many of them opposed it. Their attitude was, if Hirsch didn't establish a yeshiva, that means it's not for us. What do we need a yeshiva for? That's not our derech. If you want to train people in advanced Talmudic learning, they can go to Lithuania. But so they opposed it. He had a hard time. He had to raise. He couldn't raise the community itself. Wouldn't budget it. He had to raise the money privately. It's hard to imagine when you think back now. Just like it's hard to imagine, for instance, that Young Israel, the Young Israel movement, which is on the right wing of Orthodoxy, both of modern Orthodoxy, both politically and also religiously. Originally, they didn't want rabbis, just like in Israel, Kibbutz Adati, they didn't want rabbis. How things have changed. But he survives the war, and he comes to America. He teaches at YU, and he also was rabbi of Ohev Tzedek. Oh, it said it's Hungarian show in Upper West Side. Anyone who lived as a single on the Upper West Side, you certainly know Ohev Tzedek. So this is Yaakov Hoffman, a real Talmud Chacham, and he had a Beis Din. And we spoke about that. So that's and so this dispute went on until the war. There was even new developments in the 20th century. A grandson of Rav Bamberger. His name was Rav Yitzchak or Isaac, Isaac, Una, UNNA. Aleph Vav Nun Aleph. He was the Rav in Mannheim, a student of Rav David Tzvi Hafen, the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary, also a Talmud Chacham. There's many Unas today in Israel. He goes on Aliyah in the 30s. He actually dies during the War of Independence. And because the war was where he lived, it was so problematic, they couldn't bury people. People were, fighting was going on. He was buried in the courtyard of his house. And only a few years later was the body actually moved. Morocco. God willing, one day we'll return to Morocco. All the tours are canceled there, and it's a big problem. And there's an article today that came out that Jews in Morocco are asking, what's going on here? I thought that Morocco was different, and because they've had rallies, anti-Israel rallies. I'd say to the people in Morocco, don't sweat it. We've had the same thing here and the same genocidal chants. You can hear them in today in Penn Station. You can hear them, and you can hear them all over. So, it's not like it's any worse over there than it is here. But you had people who were buried in houses, in courtyards. We're not exactly sure why. Some people assume maybe because there was a plague and they couldn't leave when they died. They had to bury them right there. But there were these people then became kadoshim, and you'd have a house, and in one room of the house, that would be, you wouldn't put any like dirty dishes or anything there. You just keep, let's say, food. That was because that was where the kadosh was buried, whoever this kadosh was, in Tunisia, in Tunis. Those who came with me, you remember? We went to see a grave inside the house, but not just in the house, inside the, like a on the second floor of the house. How does it get to the second floor? That's an itself a question. But it's like you go into this building and you go upstairs and they're buried. So and underneath that people are living. Fascinating. Okay, so getting back, so Rav Yitzhak Unna, he was the Rav in Mannheim. I'm not saying he's one of the Gedolei Hador. He wrote a volume of Shelos and Tshuvos. He's certainly a fine rabbi, Talmud Chacham. But he becomes in the 1920s, a philosophical opponent of Austerlitz. This is not like his grandfather. As we saw, his grandfather, Rabbi Bamberger, never was, he thought, even in Frankfurt, he said, if people want to stay, it's fine. And, but if people don't want to be a member of the separatist community and want to be in the general community, this is how you can do that. Rav Unna develops, he forms an organization called Achdus. What we'd say today, Achdus. Achdus means unity. And this organization argued for the religious desirability of remaining in one community. That is, as lechatchila, as something that is actually better. Because there were plenty of people who thought that, okay, you can stay in a separate, you can, if you're in a place like Frankfurt, this doesn't apply in other communities where there's only one community. But if you're in a place like Frankfurt or Berlin, where they have both a separatist and a general community, that certainly you should be in the separatist community. If you don't, okay, there's a heter. But if you're a real serious Jew, and if you take your Yiddishkeit seriously, you'll be a member of the separatist community. That was a view that certain people had. And what Unna argues is no, that actually the chachila, the better position is to be in the general community. And he bases his argument on the notion of arevus, arevut. That is that we are all Jews are responsible one for the other. And if we, we can't make our own ghetto and go in our own little community. On the contrary, the Jews today, the non-Orthodox Jews, they're not the heretics like in previous years. They're not trying to uproot Torah. They don't know any better. And even when we battle with them, it's not because they're Rishayim or evil. They honestly believe that their position is the best Jewish position. And they're wrong from our standpoint, but they're not evil people. They're not trying to destroy things. They're expressing an honest opinion that our job is to try to change their opinion. How can we change their opinion if we're in a separatist community? We need to be together because of our Revus. We are responsible for these Jews. They're not the sort of heretics that are completely, as we say, mechutz l'machaneh, out of the fold, that we no longer have a revus, responsibility for them. No. These are unwitting heretics, and they don't know any better. They're Amoratzim, all this, and most of the Jews don't know anything. And therefore, we have responsibility. And because of this responsibility, we have to be in the general community so we can influence them, not just in matters like the old age home and the based and everything, but in our interactions with them. We have to be involved with them consistently. Now, this is a position which is very much in line with, I think, modern Orthodox Jews today, or at least many modern Orthodox rabbis. And I think they would use the very same. They don't know about Una's position. I think they would enjoy it. Maybe I should translate it. I've translated now like 10 articles from German and Hebrew, what I think classic German Orthodox writings. Maybe I should translate Rabbi Una, his justification for remaining, not just justification, sorry, his advocacy for remaining in the general community, mitam arevus, because we have responsibility to our non-Orthodox brethren. We hear a lot of people that talk about arevus, even you have to go out to the non-religious, find them. But that's not speaking about being in one community with them, like in the German sense. It just means going out and trying to make Bali Tshuva. Incidentally, the Chabad doesn't have an issue. I don't know if this is officially they don't have an issue, but on the ground, they don't have an issue being in the general communities in Berlin today. One of the rabbis in Berlin, they have the non-Orthodox rabbi, the Orthodox rabbi. The Orthodox rabbi is Roy Techtal. He's a Chabadnik. So he's the successor to the Matei Levi, Rav Mordechai Horovitz, and Rabbi Nobel, and Rav Yaakov Hoffman. And I mean, we're going to have Nachum Shmariahu and other Chabadniks who listen. Maybe you'll tell me. Maybe this is a controversy in Chabad, but I haven't heard of it. And there's other places where Chabad rabbis serve as the equivalent of communal rabbi. Because I think there are Frankfurt. I have to look. Frankfurt. Yeah, Frankfurt. I think the Chabad rabbi is the Orthodox communal rav. Although I don't know if there's a non-Orthodox communal rabbi in Frankfurt, but there is definitely a non-Orthodox communal rabbi in Berlin, and the Chabad rabbi, and the communal rabbi, and another rabbi. He's retired, but well, he's not retired actually. He was. I think they wanted to retire him for whatever reason. I don't want to get to the controversy with Ehrenberg, but he's still the rabbi of the shul. So I don't know if he's officially still recognized, but for many years, those who came to Germany with me, or if you in the main German Orthodox shul, Rav Ehrenberg, he's the Orthodox rabbi. So today, the Berlin community, just like the Frankfurt community and the Berlin community before the war, it has a general community and it has an Orthodox rabbi for the community. And it has the non-Orthodox. So Rabbi Techtal is not just a Chabad rabbi. He is also the official Orthodox rabbi. Now you have other communities where the Chabad rabbi, so for example, Bratislava, Rabbi Myers, Chabad rabbi, but he's also the official rabbi of the community. But there is only an Orthodox rabbi. There isn't another. But let's say if the community of Bratislava would also decide, let's say in a bunch of Reform Jews, move there, and they wanted to, and they're members of the community, and they wanted to have a reform community. I never heard that the Chabad would feel that they have to now withdraw from this community. No, the Chabad will be their rabbi, the Orthodox community rabbi, and for the non-Orthodox, they have their own. But I'd be curious whether this has been an issue in Chabad circles. Normally, it's the case where you have these communities, maybe the rabbi is the only one who's Torah observant, and the rest of the community is completely secular, but it's officially an Orthodox community. Now, this is an issue, as I said, that continued to the war with maybe about 10 communities that had separatist communities, and it always was the non-separatists basically didn't pay it much mind. It's my senses. They did what they did, but the separatists were always trying to push the issue and trying to say that our way is the correct way, and you're a compromiser. But the others didn't. I guess it's the equivalent. In the Haredi world, they're always coming out with statements how you can't have any involvement with the non-Orthodox, things like that. But then the non-Orthodox rabbis who do this, they don't care. They ignore it. But when you became a rabbi there, obviously this became an issue because you graduated from the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary, and sometimes you're offered a position. It could be a general position, a community position, or a separatist position. And the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin did not take a stand on this issue. Most of the Musmachim from the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin took regular rabbanus in a general community, even though the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin comes out of the separatist community. The founder of it is Israel Hildesheimer. You know, the original, the people who were there at the beginning, Yaakov Bart and Berliner, Avram Berliner, they're all from the separatist community. Hildesheimer's community is called the Atas Yisrael. This was a separatist community. And the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary was housed in the separatist community of Berlin. And it comes out of that community. However, the ideology of the seminary was not separatist. That is, it was neutral, independent. Even though it came from the separatist community, Hildesheimer and Huffman and their followers, and it was originally supported by them, it became they were careful not to use the seminary as a place to indoctrinate people with separatist ideology. It has to be said also in the Hirschian School in Frankfurt. That is the high school, the elementary school. They also did not indoctrinate separatism, and people went there who were not part of the Hirschian community. Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg was asked, wrote an essay, I should say. He wasn't asked. He wrote an essay about the separatist issue, I guess explaining the rabbinical seminary's position. And he says that we stay out of this, just like we don't speak about, you know, they didn't speak about Zionism either. This was a big dispute, religious Zionism or not. Many of the Agudistin in Germany, including students at the rabbinical seminary, were anti-Zionist. On the other hand, you had many Mizrahi people, religious Zionists. So the rabbinical seminary didn't take sides. It, like the University of Chicago, right? Not to weigh in on any controversial matters, because as we've learned in recent weeks, when these universities try to weigh in, they end up putting their foots in their mouth and show noble moral backbone. So Rabbi Weinberg says that we, the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, we stay out of this controversy, and which means what's not often said here, and we're going to see this with Chaim Moser also, is that by not saying anything, you're actually deciding against Hirsch, because the proposition of the separatists is that only a separatist community is acceptable if there's a separatist and non-separatist, and if you say, well, I'm going to punt. I'm not going to answer one way or the other. You're agreeing with Bamberger, basically. You're saying that I'm not going to say it's usher to remain a general community. I'm not going to say anything. Well, if you don't say anything, then you're not saying it's usher. And if you're not saying it's usher, that means that people can do what they want. Functionally, it's basically without saying as much, it's an agreeing with Bamberger, and that's what the Hildesheimer Seminary did, that their graduates were able to take positions in either separatist communities or non-separatist. And people studied at the rabbinical seminary came from the separatist communities and also from the general communities. Rabbi Weinberg says, what about which position is better, though? Which is more correct? Now, he's writing this at a time when there's controversy because the Rabbi Unna's Achlus organization is trying to push this issue in the direction of communal unity. And he says that this is not a question that we can answer today. This is a question that only the passage of time, he says, we're not Nevi'im. He says, only future historians will be able to pass judgment on which position was correct. That is, which it was better for the Jewish community, the Hirschian position of separatism or the unified position argued by Una or by Bamberger, given the option. And not surprisingly, historians to this day are arguing about this. Those who have a in the Orthodox world, those like Krugman who have a more separatist inclination, they'll argue for Hirsch. And those with a more open-minded or more communal perspective will argue for Bamberger. I'm in a strange situation that, hashkafa-wise, I tilt towards Bamberger, or even more, tilt toward the Mate Levi and Rav Yitzchak Unna. On the other hand, when I look at the back and forth halachically, it seems like Hirsch gets the better of the argument, but we never saw Bamberger's reply to Hirsch. So Bamberger was enough of a gadol and a great posek that I think I can perhaps assume that had he argued, had he responded, that maybe I'd now be tilting halachically for Bamberger. But be that as it may, it's a you know it's Bamberger's position is that once he sets forth what he does, it's no longer a halachic issue anymore. It's hashkafa. There's one more important source we need to see on this, and that's what we're going to see next week. Rav Chaim Moser Grudzinski, because the dispute in the early 20th century heats up to such an extent that they decide to turn to Rifkai Moshe Grudzinski to and I believe it's the Hirshians that in fact it is the Hirshians who decide to turn to him. Who the separatists wouldn't I mean the non-separatists wouldn't. I have no reason to think they wouldn't, but we don't know who we don't have the recipient of the letter, so it's hard to say, but it boggles the mind that it could be anyone other than the Hirshians. Actually, no, it's definitely the Hirshians, because as we'll see, the Reform do something else, which is terrible. And therefore, the argument is that, okay, well, maybe in Bamberger, he was dealing with one type of reform, but now we're dealing with even a worse type of reform, and Bamberger's heter no longer applies. Wait till you see what Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski says. The genius of Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski and the way he formulates matters. And some people aren't going to be upset with Rav Chaim Moshe when they see what he says. His declaration that not everything is halachic, and that sometimes to decide halacha, it's not about sources. You can't cite anything. It has to do with what your hashkafa is. So wait till you see next week. I think Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski's letter is not only one of the most important rabbinic letters in the 20th century. It shows you why he became the recognized Gadol BeYisrael, not just for the Agudistin, but for Mizrahi types, for all everyone. In fact, when Yechiyahu Weinberg, when Rav Chaim Moshe writes how you shouldn't move the seminary to Palestine, to Eretz Yisrael, Rav Yechiyahu Weinberg is all upset because he says, "Well, you're our rabbi also. Why are you forgetting about us?" So, and that'll be the last thing really that reflects on the Hirsch-Bamberger dispute. And then, well, we'll have to look at least briefly at what happened in Hungary and then to America as well. So I'm going to mark it here. So in 2 weeks, that's what we'll see, the great Rav Chaim Moshe. Now, let me get to some comments and questions here. David says, does Rav Soloveitchik also write about aninos as not necessarily being linked to practical considerations applicable only to those required to arrange the funeral, but also because of the chesed from Hashem, knowing that at this very difficult time, the mourner may be angry with Hashem, therefore halacha exempts him. He must say that because it sounds like the Rav. I don't know that, but there's already the Rishonim have two reasons, either because of Kavod HaMeis, which the way I just read it would be how the Rav explains it, or because you're involved with dealing with the dead person, arranging everything. So we assume, everyone assumes, as far as I know, that it's made both of them, but you're never pater from aninus. But there are, if you read the Rishonim and their argument, the Achronim have said that if this is the halacha, then you'd be pater from aninus, if in today's circumstances. But I don't know of anyone who halacha lemaisa. In fact, I saw a tshuva, I forget who has a whole argument saying that you're pater from aninus, but then he says, but of course, halacha lemaisa, you're not. The Rav, I don't know, I have to look. I have Rav Konigsberg has the sefer, the shiurim of the Rav on Avelos. It could be in there. That's where you get a lot of the Rav stuff on Avelos. The Rav Tutch gave shiurim on Avelos. This it was common in certain yeshivas not to give shiurim on Avelos because this is like an ayin hara or just not. The Rav didn't hold of this. He gave shiur. He taught. Gave shiur on Avelos. All the dinim of Avelos. Carla says, is the Gottlieb book the Jewish Reformation? It is indeed the Jewish Reformation. And Hirsch, half the book is on Hirsch, because I think Hirsch is, maybe you say Jewish Reformation, or with that, it would be Reformation with a small r. Carla says, Reb Bamberger's motivation for changing his mind is also well represented in Jung's Jewish Leaders. Yes, I have the book on the floor. And Bamberger, I mean, Hirsch says to Bamberger in the first open letter, how is it? It's a shock. How no one could have ever imagined. How could you say this when it goes against what you said before? And Bamberger explains in great detail everything that led up to his changing his mind, the change of circumstances. And he puts the blame on the Hirshians. He says, you're the ones who begged me to come to Frankfurt. And I told you when I come there, I'm going to speak to the other side and I can't guarantee that I'm not going to change my mind. So it's not a mystery. The Hirshians like to think, or they used to like to think, because today, who even knows about this dispute, that Rav Moshe Mainz, who was, Bamberger had a great deal of respect for him, that he he was able to twist the facts or convince Bomberger a different way. The Hirshians would say that he was able to mislead him or whatever it is, whatever language they would use. From Bomberger's perspective, he says it clearly that Ramosha Mines explained to me exactly what the negotiations are with the general community. And assuming that what he's worked out will be carried out, then there's no longer any obligation to separate. So David provides the quote from Rav Soloveitchik's Out of the Whirlwind in the Hebrew edition there. Very nice. By the way, Carla, Professor Sulzbach, also an expert in German Orthodoxy. Many, many years ago, I read your master's dissertation. I was one of the readers. Translation of Rav David Zvi Hoffman's critique of Wellhausen's work on biblical criticism. We hope one day that this will appear in print in publication. I have a copy of it, but I know many people have asked me many times over the years, is there any translation of it? And I say there's a Hebrew translation, and but the English translation is not widely available. So someone privately said that Rabbi Riskin revoked the smicha of someone. I can mention the name because he's a known maneuver. Mordechai Gafni, Mark Winiers. I mean, this is not one guy, a guy who made one mistake or two mistakes. This is a guy. There's always gullible people, especially in this crowd of the spiritual seekers, the people who put spirituality, those types. You can do crazy, terrible things 10, 20 times, and you always in that crowd you can always find gullible people, and then they're shocked when a bad thing happens again, and like how could we know? How could we know? But so Rabbi Riskin revoked his smicha. I don't know, but if from his standpoint, he was given it. Can a university revoke? A university can't revoke your diploma unless they found that you were engaged in, let's say, you plagiarized in the news recently at my alma mater. I tell you that if she was in my class, I would not have failed her for the whole semester. That's my policy for real plagiarism. Her plagiarism was of the sort she would have got an F on the paper, but not a failure for the whole semester. But it's. It's not a very good time to be a Harvard alumnus. It's really embarrassing in so many ways. But you can't revoke just because someone adopts a different position. You can't revoke their diploma. But smicha, I guess, is different. Thank you, Nissan, for providing the link to Professor Michael Gottlieb from NYU. Marty says that he has an unusual situation when his father Zal passed away. He died in Toronto, and Marty was hospitalized in New York. The rabbis told me because I couldn't help prepare for the funeral, I never became an Onin. They told me to start observing Halachos HaAvelos right away. Thus, there was a minion in my hospital the day before my father's burial, and I said, Kaddish, that's fascinating, Marty, you say that. Because that's the exact position of the Rishonim I mentioned, but it's the exact position that I've never seen in print, Halacha Lemaisa. And I just said that I read this whole tshuva where the Rav says this is what it should be today, but then he says, but Halacha Lemaisa, we don't do it that way because we assume that there's also the issue of Kavod HaMeis. I would love to know, because, Marty, what you're saying applies in many, many cases. Sometimes people are, today it's very different. We fly everywhere for funerals. Think during COVID, though. Someone in Eretz Yisrael dies and you're in America. Are we saying now that the person's never an Onei? As far as I know, we never said that. We said that he is an Onin, and when if the funeral was at, say, 2 p.m., these days you watch it on Zoom, then you become an Ovo. I looked and looked at online at various tshuvos on this because of the issue, and I didn't find anyone halacha lemaisa to adopt this position. And
Dr. Mark, if I can say,
yes.
And when I was, the shul, whatever, the shul, it is more common when people, let's say, would fly to Israel for burial, and not everybody in the family would go. So parts of the family would sit Shiva immediately before the
It would,
burial.
okay.
And people would come back in the middle. I mean, it happened with my grandfather, that my mother went and my grandmother didn't go, and they ended Shiva like a day apart because, they started
I
burial.
didn't know that. I haven't had
And
much
it's
involvement with
not
it.
so uncommon. And I know people, unfortunately, in
But then
COVID,
why my wife
they
was in
sat
this
Shiva right away.
situation the Friday. The body is not with her. She has nothing to do with
No,
it.
but
So
if
based on
they're
that,
going
why
to
was
the
she eliminated on
funeral,
Friday?
this is only when they're not going to the funeral I'm talking about. If they're going to go to the funeral, then there'll always be an O-name regardless, even though they're not involved in the burial. That's, I think, what the question you're referring to. In other words, a person has nothing to
Have
do
to
with
go to
this
the
planet.
funeral. Why do you have to go to the
But
why do you have to go to the funeral?
if they're going to the funeral, they remain an O-name until the
No,
funeral, and
but the
then it's
Svar of
less.
the Rishonim has nothing to do with going to the funeral. The Svar of the Rishonim is because you're not involved with it.
I understand,
And
but
they assume that you would be involved
there
there,
I
even they
think
assume you're
that
involved
I've never
even
seen.
before the funeral. Now it could be, I think Shiva only will start after the funeral, but they assume that you're an Avel even before the funeral, as I
No,
recall.
the Shiva starts right away. If you don't go to the
So then
funeral,
Shiva, so then
the Shiva
so if
starts
those
right away.
Rishonim, then why would you be what's the funeral? What's the funeral have to do with anything?
No, because if you're going to the funeral, then it's the second reason, and the person before the funeral is not in the state
Oh,
of
cover
mind
a
to be
mace.
an
Oh, cover a
Avel, blah,
mace.
blah, blah.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, I never investigated these matters before until she was nifter, and then all of a sudden it occurred to me and I'm thinking about it. And one rabbi suggested, I'm not sure why others didn't say that if there's a suffix, I should make the bracha. I'm have to make the bracha on the Shabbos candles. He didn't say that I should light the Shabbos candles. He said that she can light it and I make the bracha. But oh, and Naftali says that the Divrei Kehillos has just been republished. I have the Divrei Kehillos is all the Minhagim of Old Frankfurt from Abraham Geiger's older brother, who's a big Talmid Chacham. It's I have to look at the Sefer if it was obviously a new print, but if they have good footnotes or anything, if it's just the actual Sefer, I reprinted it from HebrewBooks.org. I mean, there's stuff that'll you find shocking in the old Frankfurt Minhag. To this day, I think it continues. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe the pressure caused them to change it. No Yisker. In Frankfurt, there was no Yisker. I think, if I'm not mistaken, that the public was someone told me that public pressure in Washington Heights forced them to put in Yisker because you have people who are not from the Frankfurt community. But the old Frankfurt Minhag is no Yisker. Samuel says that Ashkenazim gave their children names of animals. Yes, Sephardim did not,
I can
as far as I know. But my point was, why a dove? Because the
I'll
Gemara says a bad thing about bears.
tell you because we continue it says based on the brachas of Yaakov Avinu in Vayechi. So it's Aryeh Leib, Zev Wolf, Naphtali Tzvi, but they didn't want to call Yisachar Chamor, like Shem. So they
Yes.
called him Dov, wishing him the strength of a bear. They felt that the strength and energy of an animal could be transferred to an infant as a source of vitality and power.
Oh,
And
so you take instead of chamor, you give it the dove.
the
Okay, that's interesting. I don't know if historically that's the reason, but it's a great reason.
and
It's as good as any other reason.
also
Because are there any other animals? I don't know if they knew about tigers. I mean, tigers are not in. I don't know if they heard of tigers. Yeah. What else, please?
also the word chaya means a living thing, not just an animal. See, not just a beast. So they transferred it. Matter of fact, the Sfardim, especially in Israel, a lot of them are amused. They're amazed about the menagerie in the families of their Ashkenazi neighbors.
Today, Sfardim in Israel, do they use names like this? Tzvi and
Oh, I don't.
Dover? No.
No, I think
No. Okay.
Italians in the Middle Ages. Used it for a time, but otherwise in North Africa or the Sephardim, they don't use it. No.
Okay, that's interesting. By the way, you mentioned Italians. I'll tell you my favorite Italian name. There's an they also had in Italy, they had a Shem Chol. So, Angel, Angel, Angelo. So the name Angel in Italian, however you pronounce it, was in Hebrew, the name would be Mordechai. Why? Because of the Agadah that Malachi is the same as Mordechai. So, like, they don't want to name Malachi. So Mordechai is Malachi. So Mordechai equals Angel. Carla says, by not establishing yeshiva, Hershey and Judaism, they will have signed the end of true Yekidim, end of the Minhag. Yeah, well, when they came to America, the Frankfurt people had a choice to make. They could have gone to YU, or they could have gone to Lakewood. And they chose to go to Lakewood, and the assumption, rather, Breuer and others, was that they go to get the Torah from Lakewood. But they'll still keep our minhagim and our philosophy, our way of life. But you know what? If you're in Lakewood, or if Aaron Cutler is good enough for you to get his Torah, then he's good, and you're going to take his hashkafa also. So but you know what? It's at the time, it would have been hard to create a yeshiva. It wasn't such a big community. The Gera Rebbe, Nissen said, is buried in a yeshiva courtyard during the 48 war. Too. I don't know. Was it Yeshiva Court? I don't know. But I've been to the Ger Rebbe. It's by Machane Yehuda. You can go see it. Thank you again, Samuel. That's fascinating. So Carla says in Amsterdam, Rabbi Yehuda Jacobs is the official chief rabbi and is also Chabad. But does Amsterdam also have a non-Orthodox rabbi on salary as an
Yes.
official non-Orthodox rabbi?
The liberal rabbi.
Yes, I do. Okay, so that's the case we're speaking about. I didn't know that about Amsterdam, that they had that. Okay, so Chabad apparently has no problem doing this. Interesting. And Nissen says Rav Techtel is the senator of the Yom HaSmecha who abandoned the Satmar anti-Zionist ideology after the Holocaust. He abandoned it during the Holocaust, Nissen.
Yes,
he
and I was
publishes the book in
corrected.
Budapest in
He was
43.
and he was a chassid of the primary anti-Zionist. The Minchas
Yes.
Aluzer, I was corrected by our colleague,
Yes.
not of the Samar,
Yes.
who
Yes.
was an anti-Zionist more than the Samar.
Yes. Exactly. One of the children became Chabad. In fact, in the Merkas Harav put out an edition of Eim HaMonim Smecha with footnotes. That was the edition we use when we were in yeshiva. And this son from, I guess, the father of this Techtel, he wrote a Hakdama there. And he cites, you know, from the Lubavitcher Rebbe that everyone should know that he was not a Tzioni. My father was not at Tzioni. He was just Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. So it's a dispute between how you view him, but I think it's pretty clear. Privately, someone says Rav Shlomo Breuer and Yosef Breuer had many Talmidim who went to the East to learn. Rav Schwab, Rav Lobe. Oh yes, in between Yeshiva and Modern Orthodoxy, I discussed this. I actually interviewed Rabbi Schwab about this. I discussed the whole movement to the East in the 1920s and 1930s. Just like today, our young people go to Israel to learn. They went to study in Eastern Europe. And yes, okay, thank you. Two classes in 2 weeks. Carla, thank you for telling us you translate his Mar Samuel. That's the work that Hirsch condemned. And his attack on the Wellhausen book is also being worked on. The Mar Samuel book, I can't tell you how many people have asked me about a translation for that. We sort of had to end, but David says Aryeh is very common among Sfaradim. And we have Devorah, Hulda, Rachel, Yael, all animal names. So, of course, they're new animal names. Thank you all. I can't stay on anymore. My son is flying. I have to go to the airport to get him. And he's flying to Israel tomorrow, Mirtz Hashem. How's he flying? Lufthansa doesn't start up till El Al was too much. It was over 3,000. It was like $3,500 if I booked 3 days in advance. Lufthansa is still not flying. You can fly United to Milan. It gets there 8 a.m. and El Al flies like 11:15. So that's enough time. So all three of my kids will be in Israel by next week. So thank you all for coming. Rabbi Kelman, if you have some words, but I have to check out because I got to go to the airport.
Okay, good. Everything.
See you in 2 weeks.
As I mentioned, the Mark will, he's not speaking next Monday night, but he is speaking next Monday morning. For those who weren't in that 8:30, we're having a Yom Iyun. I just sent out a little note about it. Really should be a fascinating program. December 25th. No, I don't think, well, many of you live in Israel, but I don't think anybody here is working that day. So next Monday, we'll have at least six speakers. We may be adding a seventh. We'll see. But I just put the registration. So Mark is speaking on Monday morning, speaking about Islam, Judaism and Islam. We're going to have Judaism and Christianity, Zoroastrianism. Marty Lection will give a talk on Christian influences, on Parshanut, Shai Sekunda will speak, if you know the name, Yaakov Nagin, Rosh Hashiva Otniel, of course, who grew up in New York. He's actually a Ganak. He changed his name from Ganak to Nagin. He's very involved in Muslim-Jewish relations, so he'll be speaking on that. Malka Simkowitz will be speaking on Christian relations. Anyways, I just sent out the link. I put it here in the box. So please do register for that. And the other way, and then I recognize this. So Rabbi Shimon, we tomorrow we'll have, of course, our classes will be continuing, of course, over winter break. I don't know what it's like most places, but in Toronto, still the modern Orthodox schools still give off between Christmas and New Year's. We get 2 weeks off at Chap, beginning this Friday till January 8th, and that's what they do in the modern schools. I think in New York, much less so, but it's interesting. That's always been the minhag here. People are shaking their heads, saying, "Oh, that's bad. Whatever, good, bad. I don't know." But that's the way it is. That's when parents are off. Remember, we get Boxing Day in Canada, so we have an extra day vacation. The parents like it. Anyways, that's the way it goes. So, anyways, 1 2 weeks off of school starting this Friday. But enough of that. And everybody be well. Lila told me, hope to see you soon. We should hear good news. Good news here in Israel. David, how are things? Are you okay?
They're good.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, listen, we should hear good news. I don't know if the mood's getting any better. If people fear worse, I don't know. The casualties are mounting. On the other hand, it seems they're making, progress. I don't know. It's a tough situation. But what
Yeah,
can I
they've
say?
released the name of a soldier that was killed a few hours ago, Silberg. Apparently, his grandfather was a well-known rav in, from London.
Silberg.
Silberg, yeah. I was with a friend of mine. He said that his grandfather was his rabbi in Hasmonean.
No, terrible. Baruch Dan Emet. It's we should hope we should have atzlacha without casualties. What can we say? But all right, listen. All right, everybody, we should hear good news and continue. And
Thank
our
you.
learning should be beschut. And okay, what and
Shalom
let's go.
aleinu ve'al kol Yisrael.
Amen. Amen.
Amen.
Well done.
Okay. All right. Be well, everybody. Laila Tov, Boker Tov, David. Okay. And everybody be well.